If you like, you can go ahead and make your way over to 1 Samuel chapter 4. 1 Samuel chapter 4. We'll be spending some time there in just a few minutes. Whenever I find out someone's expecting, I always like to ask, what name have you got chosen? And you got people who are secretive, who don't tell anybody, and that's okay. But a lot of times people will say, well, we hadn't quite narrowed it down, you know, and usually at that point I suggest Greg or Gregette as a really good name for the child. That usually doesn't go over too well, though. One name I have never heard suggested, though, is Ichabod. Of all of the odd names that have been selected over the past few years, that's just not one of them. And the reason for that is even in the 21st century, it's got a very negative connotation to it. It's associated with a statement that says the glory of God has departed. And so typically, you're going to hear the name Ichabod in one of two places, either the Bible or in the legend of Sleepy Hollow. Those are about the only two Ichabods that I know, maybe a few others scattered across history. And the reason this name is in such a negative connotation is because it is in a very dark place of the Old Testament. A time when there's going to be a great amount of death because of people's disrespect for God. And so I want to talk about that here in just a few minutes. But to really get the picture of what's going on, we got to back up. We got to do a little bit of ground laying first. And that's going back to the Garden of Eden in its association with the tabernacle. When we turn back to the book of Genesis, those early chapters, we find that Eden is as much an idea as it is a place. Definitely a physical location. But the physical location is representing a place where humanity and God are coming together in absolute harmony. They're coming together as the creator and the created, but even more than that, as partners in this creation. And so those early days of humanity's history were very good days. When God would come and He would walk with the man and woman and He would teach them and He would give His wisdom. But that perfection was based on the premise that you must respect God. God said, by giving a command concerning a tree, you got to trust me. That when I say, do not eat from the tree of knowledge of good and evil, you've got to trust that what I'm telling you is good and right. And if you accept my wisdom, then this relationship can continue and flourish. And I think the basic idea is that the Garden of Eden was going to expand over the earth, that this idea would be pushed out to future generations, and everybody would be living in harmony with God. But we know that Adam and Eve took things in a very different direction. And so because of their failure to respect God, to listen to Him, to accept His wisdom, God says, the day you eat of that tree, you're going to die. And the day that they ate of that tree, God expelled them from the garden. He put them back out into the realm of death. And He demonstrated what happens when you don't accept and appreciate and follow the wisdom of God. And to make that even more serious, there at the entry to the Garden of Eden, He stationed two cherubim. And this may sound a little strange if you've never thought through a lot of this, but the cherubim are there for mankind's protection. They're no longer able to go into the presence of God. They have violated the terms of the covenant, so to speak. And so the cherubim are there as a reminder, and that flaming sword that went in every direction, that this is now off limits to you. Because you are no longer in the relationship that you can have this walking with God kind of lifestyle. I think it's likely that the Garden of Eden was on a mountain. And so you can imagine that here was that little pass up to the garden and stationed there as a constant reminder to Adam and Eve was the fact that you could not ever go back in. But that was not a permanent condition for mankind. In fact, in Genesis chapter 3, God starts the discussion of how He's going to bring people back into that relationship. And part of that is going to be seen in his insistence that his people, Israel, build a tabernacle that would be in the middle of their camp. And when you begin reading the description of that tabernacle, and really even more so later with the construction of the temple, there's all of these little flourishes in it that are taking us back to a garden setting. The fruit and the trees that are later engraved into the walls, the cherubim that are in the curtains, even the lampstand with its appearance as a plant or a tree, all of these things are a reminder that Eden, while it was lost, has not been forgotten, and it is available, but it's going to take a while for mankind to work their way back. So over the past few weeks, we've been talking specifically about the Ark of the Covenant. And here in the most holy place of the tabernacle sat the Eden ideal, the reminder of what it was all about. And we see that, a passage that we referenced a week or two back, where God says, "You shall put the mercy seat on top of the ark, and in the ark you shall put the testimony that I shall give you. There I will meet with you. And from above the mercy seat, from between the two cherubim that are on the ark of the testimony, I will speak to you about all that I will give you in commandment for the people of Israel." In other words, when you come to the mercy seat, I'm going to explain wisdom to you, which is what the law was. It was the wisdom of God that said, this is how you can be like me, this is how you can walk with me. And as we've mentioned, when the high priest would come in on the Day of Atonement, he would come in from amongst the people. And so what he did in that was became the representative human. So he's coming from amongst the people through the courtyard, through the holy place, to the most holy. But first, he's made all of these provisions. If you'll recall, he's made all of these provisions. He's offered the sacrifice for his own sins. He's coming in having had a sacrifice for the people's sin, that he's sprinkling the blood on the mercy seat so that as God looked at that law, he looked at it through mercy and in turn could then dwell amongst the people. But here's something we need to remember, that while the original Eden picture was expansive, obey God, accept His wisdom, and build Eden out, the tabernacle, in a sense, almost reminded us of the opposite. It was a very exclusive place. Only a certain number of people could come into the courtyard. Only a certain number of people could come into the most holy, into the holy place. But only one could come into the most holy place. And so it was a reminder that while God was working to get mankind back to that Eden relationship, it was not there yet. Now, with that background, we come to 1 Samuel chapter 4. And in 1 Samuel chapter 4, we're going to see some actions that were very bad. And we're going to see results of those actions that were very serious. So let's set the stage for this. Israel has been in a battle with the Philistines, as was not uncommon. However, things had gone very poorly for them. And so if you look in verse 2 of chapter 4, it says, "The Philistines drew up in line against Israel, and when the battle spread, Israel was defeated by the Philistines, who killed about 4,000 men on the field of battle." Here are God's people who suffer a major defeat by a pagan group. And so at this point, the nation of Israel ask the right question. They're going to say, "Look, we've lost to these people, these worshipers of a false god. Why has Yahweh defeated us today before the Philistines?" Right question. If we're the people of God, and God is not allowing us to win, not protecting us, something's wrong here. The problem, though, is that though they're asking the right question, they're not waiting for the right answer. And so what we find is that in trying to seek the answer, they're going to ignore consulting the one who would have known, and they're going to do something quite wrong in the process. Something in the text here, I believe, is given to us to set the stage for their unwillingness to accept the message of God. Let's back up just a little bit into chapter 3. You'll recall that chapter 3 is all about Samuel and his getting the message from God and the judgment that's being pronounced on Eli's family. But let's look down to verse 20. And it says, all Israel from Dan to Beersheba knew that Samuel was established as a prophet of the Lord. Right? Number one, all Israel knew Samuel was established as a prophet of the Lord. Look at verse 21. And the Lord appeared again at Shiloh, for the Lord revealed Himself to Samuel at Shiloh by the word of the Lord. Everybody knows he's a prophet. The text tells us Samuel received this revelation of God through His word. Look at verse 1 of chapter 4. And the word of Samuel came to all Israel. Three times preceding this section that we're looking at, God makes sure we know. Everybody knew Samuel was a prophet. I gave Samuel His word. I revealed Myself to him through the word. And then finally, that the word came to Samuel for all of Israel. But yet we're not going to read about Samuel again for about three chapters. Everything that's going on here, we're not going to see anybody going to him. We're not going to see anybody seeking the Lord through him. And so Israel asked the right question, but they didn't go to the one who could give the answer. Instead, the elders of Israel say, we got a great idea. Instead of seeking Samuel, let's go get the Ark of the Covenant. What's going on in their heads? Well, the text doesn't tell us. We could speculate. I don't think it'd be too far of a speculation to think if you are in battle and things are looking pretty severe, is there anything historically that you can think of that might help? Wasn't there that time that they took the ark and they marched around Jericho all those different times and the wall fell? Whatever was going through their minds, they said, let's go get the ark, which is bad enough. But what they say about the ark makes it even worse. They say, perhaps it will save us. Why did Joshua win the battle of Jericho? It wasn't because of an ark of the covenant. It was because of the God who was enthroned above the mercy seat. It was because they were diligently seeking the one who had the power of heaven and earth at His disposal, who could give His people the victory. Yet that was not on the minds of these folks. And so here on the battlefield comes the Ark of the Covenant. At this point, our writer is going to give us some very ominous descriptions. And we got to make sure we don't read over these, because I want you to listen to what he calls the Ark of the Covenant. He says, first of all, the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord of Hosts. So in verse 4, as they're bringing this from Shiloh, this is how the writer describes that. That term, that description, Lord of Hosts, comes up a lot in the Old Testament. And what that typically is going to mean is something like the Lord of Armies or the Lord of War. And that might sound good at the moment. Great. The God of armies is on our side. His box is going to win us the battle. The Lord of war is going to fight for us. We're in good shape. That's not what the writer is saying, because he's going to include it with the second description where he says the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord of Hosts enthroned on the cherubim. If you'll recall, the cherubim are in some sense depicted as the protectors of God. Not that God needs protection, but as the heavenly hosts that are with Him, these fierce beings with their four faces, they can go in any direction. And so there is a great amount of fear associated with them. And so you've got the Lord of armies enthroned on the cherubim. I think, now you, if you can find elsewhere, you can prove me wrong on this, I think that description is only found three times in the Old Testament, putting all this together. The Ark of the Covenant of the Lord of Hosts enthroned on the cherubim. Two of those times are going to be associated with the incorrect use of the Ark of the Covenant. Here, and when David tries to transport it to Jerusalem. Only one time will a very humble king who throws himself at the mercy of God see that description. it's more than three, it's not many more. But yet two of those are showing us a very dangerous situation. Then we find a third thing going on that is equally ominous. It says that Hophni and Phinehas were there with the Ark of the Covenant. These are the sons of Eli. And so why is that a bad thing? Why is it that that gives us a negative feeling here? Well, it's because we know about them, that these men were both adulterers and thieves. We're going to find that we are told that they committed fornication, adultery really, because we find out about a wife later on, right there at the door of the tabernacle with the women who were there. And we find out that they very inappropriately would take part of the sacrifice that really didn't belong to them. These were bad guys. And part of that's brought out in the Lord's message to Samuel that he delivered to Eli about how wicked the family was. You hadn't restrained your sons. All of these things are showing us some really, really scary things. But yet, at first, Israel decides this is good. And so in verse 5, when the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord came into the camp, all Israel gave a mighty shout, and the earth resounded. When they see the ark coming, this is the picture of their salvation. The Lord, not the Lord, the box is going to save us. And very temporarily, the Philistines are terrified. These warring people, look at what they say in verse 7. A god has come into the camp. And they said, "Woe to us, for nothing like this has happened before. Woe to us, who can deliver us from the power of these mighty gods? These are the gods who struck the Egyptians with every sort of plague in the wilderness. Take courage and be men, O Philistines, lest you become slaves to the Hebrews as they have been to you. Be men and fight." So here we've got the situation set up. A defeat led to a very bad idea. The very bad idea seems to be a great idea. And the people who are victorious are at first terrified. Let's see what happens. As this begins to play out, this section is going to have a whole lot of death. A whole lot of folks are about to die, beginning with what goes on in the battle. As we see all of this taking place and the Philistines coming, we go down to verse 10. At the end of it, it says, "There was a very great slaughter, and for there fell for Israel 30,000 foot soldiers. 4,000 have already died. That was considered a disaster. But now we find that 30,000 of the army are killed, but we're not done yet. Somewhat in passing, God says, "And Hophni and Phinehas died too." We already knew that was coming. But yet here they die, it appears, on the battlefield. The man takes off to go back and to tell the old prophet, the old priest, the old judge, what's going on. And so Eli, we're told, is sitting by the road trembling for the Ark of the Covenant. That word tremble has a couple of ideas. It's not only the idea of being scared, but it's also the idea sometimes we get about coming into the presence of God. A little bit of trepidation in the fact that we're coming before the Lord of the universe. And so there's a mixture here as Eli knows this is wrong and he knows things have been done incorrectly and he's trembling and this guy comes up, he says, "Give me a report." And the guy says, "Well, your sons are dead and the Ark of the Covenant has been stolen." And it's upon hearing that the ark has been taken, that we find that Eli falls backward and he dies upon hearing that news. And now we come to Ichabod. Eli's daughter-in-law, very pregnant at the time, hears what's happened. She hears about the death of her husband. She hears about the death of Eli. She hears about the death or about the ark being taken. And this has such an impact on her that it's going to take her life too. And it says as she's dying, the baby's being born and they're trying to comfort her. And she has one last word and she says, "I want you to name him Ichabod." Because Ichabod means inglorious. In other words, the day that that child is born is going to be a foundational day for remembering how the Lord has deserted His people because of their wickedness. And so Ichabod now comes into the world in a very dark time with a name to remind everyone of that dark time. But why did all of this go on? I want to suggest to you that Eden was stormed. That's why all of this went on. There are a couple things we need to note about this. First of all, unauthorized men entered the most holy place. I realize the text does not say specifically that Hophni and Phinehas went into the most holy place, but it says they were there with the ark. We know it was not Eli. I think by the process of deduction, we find that these men, these adulterous men, these thieves, made their way into the heart of the tabernacle, which represented the meeting place of God and man, where God was going to say His commands, His wisdom to them, and they took it out of that setting. And then we also find this, that because death reigned in a situation where humans were unprepared to meet God. You remember how you got to the Ark of the Covenant? You came out from amongst the people. You offered the sacrifice for yourself. You offered the sacrifice for the people. You entered clean. You had the incense that was kind of blocking the view between you and the Ark of the Covenant. You sprinkle the blood. Here now was not God looking through the blood at His people. Here was God looking at people who stormed Eden, who went past the cherubim, who tried to seize the presence of God on their own terms, and just like God promised, death will result. Whether you're a soldier, whether you're an evil priest, whether you're a high priest who hasn't ruled your sons, death is going to result. And what a dark picture that as the carnage lay on the battlefield, the Ark of the Covenant is taken off away from the people of God into a pagan land. What do we learn from this? As we read this story, it's not one that fills us with a lot of inspiration. It's not an exciting time. It's not like when we talk about the high priest and how he's kind of that picture of Jesus Christ. Here is a dark, dark picture, but yet it's included for us for a reason. And it's a reminder that you come to God on His terms. That you meet God in the way that God says to come. What this group of Israelites didn't realize is something essential that you and I must realize. And that is, you do not take God lightly. When you are dealing with God, this is not someone who's there for your whims. This is the Creator. And the way that one sees this within the storyline is that Israel has the same view of their God that the pagans had of Him. Do you notice that? Israel says about the Ark of the Covenant, it will save us. The Philistines say, the gods, the plurality, the gods of Israel. Both are pagan. Here are a people who had the opportunity to know God, to be His, to have God in their midst, yet in their minds, their God is really no different than Dagon or any of these others that's represented by some object. And in that, you and I must be careful. God says, I am a glorious God, and you must approach Me in appreciation of that glory. Let me tell you something I kind of think about the text. Take it for that. If you go back to verse 18, we're given a description of the death of Eli. It says, as soon as he mentioned the Ark of God, Eli fell over backward from his seat by the side of the gate, and his neck was broken and he died. For the man was old and heavy. That could mean two things. It could mean he was fat, which is typically how we take it. Or it could mean that he was kind of weighed down with old age. You know, as we get older, it's kind of hard to maintain mobility, and you've got kind of that heaviness of age. It could be either of those. I don't think that makes a lot of difference, because I believe our writer's playing a little word game with us here. That same word for heavy is a derivative of the word for glory. And so you've got two pictures of glory here. You've got the heaviness of Eli killing him, and you've got the glory of Israel, the heaviness of Israel walking out of the camp, right? Because of the name Ichabod, we're learning that. And so the writer is saying, look what kills you. Eli was an old man. He could not rein in his sons. He wouldn't have had the physical strength to do that. And if it was indeed he was kind of on the obese side, that would have even made him more unable. But that's not our point. Our point is he didn't restrain these guys early on. He didn't teach them how to be priests of God. And so here in his death, that heaviness in a sense is killing him, as he knows now that the heaviness of God is departing from the camp. So as we consider that, we need to understand God is not going to stay with a people who fail to respect Him. Doesn't the introduction to Revelation tell us that? Your candlestick's in danger. I'm not going to stay with people who are not committed to me, who are not deeply devoted to recognizing who I am and what I do. And so we need to understand that. And in understanding that glory, we need to understand also that spirituality and superstition are not the same thing. For years, centuries, millennia, that distinction has not been maintained. And so even today, in our times, oftentimes when someone is berating religion, spirituality, they'll say it's just the latest, the newest superstition. Well, that's what was going on here. Because Israel viewed the ark as a good luck charm. It's all it was to them. If we can get this box in our camp, somehow we're going to channel God. He's going to do our bidding for us. Now, whether they put it in that detailed terms, I don't know, but that's certainly the idea that we've got here. But how easy that is to allow the ideas of spiritual things to become nothing more than a lucky rabbit's foot or a four-leaf clover. Jeremiah, my heart goes out to him whenever I read his book. He prophesied in such difficult times, but he dealt with something very similar. And I want to include this because it gives us such a good picture of the contrast between spirituality and superstition. Thus says the Lord of hosts, Jeremiah tells us, the God of Israel, amend your ways and your deeds, and I will let you dwell in this place. Do not trust in these deceptive words. This is the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord. For if you truly amend your ways and your deeds, if you truly execute justice with one another, if you do not oppress the sojourner and fatherless or the widow or shed innocent blood in this place, and if you do not go after other gods to your own harm, then I will let you dwell in this place forever, in the land that I gave of old to your fathers forever. You hear what he's saying? Here were people that would look up and they would say, we got the temple of the Lord. Three times he repeats it. He says, is that your good luck charm? Yes. Yes, that's what they were treating it like. Just like the Ark of the Covenant earlier. Jeremiah says, forget all that. He says, if you want to stay with God, if you want to remain with God, then let God impact your life. Let God change everything about you so that you are seeking His wisdom, His glory. That's the difference. And so throughout the Bible, we find various times when this is the case. Matthew 6, perfect example. You've got Pharisees praying to be heard of men. You've got Gentiles mumbling and bumbling through a series of words to try to tune in to the right God. That's superstition. You're not doing that for God, is what Jesus is saying. We listen to the words of Paul in 2 Timothy 3 about false teachers, where he ends it by saying, oh, they've got an appearance of God, but He's not with them. We can easily see it in the Pharisees. We can easily see it in pagans. We can easily see it in false teachers. Can we so easily see it in ourselves? Here's the real question. Is my relationship with God defined in simple terms as church? Since I go to church, since I partake of the Lord's Supper, I'm good. I'm doing all of these religious things. So therefore, because I'm doing religious things, I am right with God. Well, we need to do those religious things. Those are not unimportant. But if that becomes the identifier of my relationship with God, I am just like those folks saying about the Ark of the Covenant, may it save us. I haven't come to terms with the fact that I am serving a God in heaven who controls everything. That's the difference. Let me give one more thought. We take Him seriously. We realize this is not a product of superstition. But perhaps overarching all of this is that we are to meet God on His terms. You look over the course of world history, and there has been this constant drumbeat of trying to turn this around, of saying, I want God to meet me on my terms. Religions have been formed on it. Wars have been fought over it. Churches have been established on it. It's something that humanity seems to really struggle with. God says to us, you got to come to me. If you look in your text here, chapter 7 is where we meet Samuel once again. After chapter 4, verse 1, last mention of him, till we get to chapter 7. This appears to be years later. The time frame here, years have gone by since this dark day. But the way the writer has set it up is so we'll read this immediately after reading that account of what went on in the battlefield. I want you to listen to what Samuel tells the people. He says, if you are returning to the Lord with all your heart, then put away the foreign gods and the Ashtaroth from among you, and direct your heart to the Lord and serve Him only, and He will deliver you out of the hand of the Philistines. You see the couplet there? Go to the Lord with all your heart, the negative, put away your foreign gods. Serve the Lord only, direct your heart. You see what's going on? Samuel is saying to the people then, as he says to us, if you want a relationship with God, He's number one. He's the Lord of hosts enthroned above the mercy seat. He's the king. He's the boss. He gets to say the rules. Why? Because of who He is and what He offers. So then, we understand that God has never desired anything less than that Eden relationship. That's what He wants. That's what He started out with mankind, and mankind blew it, and immediately He begins working to get us back. So when I look at His Word, if I look at this book and I say, I just can't stand all those rules, what I'm really saying is I just don't want the wisdom of God. Because that's what it's all about. God is saying to the one who will live with Him in Eden is, you got to respect my wisdom. You got to respect the fact that I know better than you. And you've got to respect my glory and want this relationship. You see, that's the difference. The relationship is relegated to rule following, superstition, only when it's like, well, if I can go through A, B, and C, then God has to save me. Total disrespect of His glory. God is saying sin broke that relationship. But if you'll trust me, I'll get you back to where you need to be. And so for the people of God, as we think about becoming Christians, it's beginning that journey back to eat, to trust that though the things we do may look foolish to humanity, we trust that if the God of the universe has said it's the right way, it's the right way. Why? Because He loves us and He wants us to love Him. and to respect His wisdom. And thus that dark day so long ago can be a light for us. When we can look at the mistakes that were made, the attitudes that destroyed, and say that is not what God wants, and to live my life then according to what He desires. And so I'll remind all of us that any lesser view minimizes what God has to offer. Any lesser view is going to say that God is not that powerful. But when I see Him for who He is, the God who loves me, the God who created mankind for that relationship with Him, then I understand that this is the God who saves. Israel was offered a path back many, many times. And God still offers a path back to us, to Him today. This morning, you may find that your life in relation to God maybe has been ignoring Him. Maybe it's been a little on the superstitious side. Whatever the case, this morning, if you have a clear understanding of who God is and who you are, and understand that God desires to save, and that He saves through the blood of Jesus Christ, and that blood is going to save you at the point of your baptism, you are ready to begin your journey back to Eden. There's no better day than today to do that. And so I encourage you, either if you want to come down front now and make that known, or catch me afterwards, whatever, that you recognize God for who He is. And thank Him for the fact that He has loved us enough to give us another day to enter into that glory with Him. If you need to respond to His invitation, you can come as we stand and sing.